Good morning, everyone. We're going to start today's session of the course on ethical and regulatory aspects of human subjects research. This morning, our first speaker will address the use of placebos in controlled clinical trials. And to talk about this, someone who's written extensively on the ethics of using placebos in clinical trials is Frank Miller, who's a member of our department here of bioethics here at the Clinical Center, and very good speaker on this topic. Frank? I should make one reminder. If you didn't sign in, please do. And don't forget to fill out your forms for credit if you want it at the end of the course.
So let me see. It's this. This goes this way is four. Okay. Great. Okay. So it's a pleasure to be here today. And since I work here, I need to let you know that these are my views, not the government's views. So placebo-controlled trials raise distinctive ethical concerns, particularly when proven effective treatments exist for a condition. Nevertheless, placebo-controlled trials, despite proven effective treatment, are very common to test new treatments, in particular for psychiatric and neurological conditions, and for a wide range of treatments to relieve pain. So what I'm going to do this morning is to examine critically two leading arguments against placebo-controlled trials when proven effective treatments are in practice. And I'm going to present some ethical criteria for justification of placebo-controlled trials to withhold proven effective treatment. To give a little bit of background, ethical concerns have been raised about control groups not receiving treatment since the 1940s with the advent of randomized controlled trials. And the recent debate over placebo-controlled trials intensified in 1994 following a New England Journal of Medicine sounding board article by Rothman and Michaels, the continuing unethical use of placebo controls. The Declaration of Helsinki, the leading international guidance for research ethics, has been at the center of this debate over placebo-controlled trials and had its last major revision in October of 2000. And here's the language in the declaration that applies to placebo controls. It states that the benefits, risk, burdens, and effectiveness of a new method should be tested against those of the best current prophylactic, diagnostic, and therapeutic putic methods. This does not exclude the use of placebo or no treatment for studies where no proven prophylactic, diagnostic, or therapeutic method is available. Now, only a year later, in 2001, the World Medical Association, which is responsible for the declaration, issued a so-called note of clarification. I'm not going to actually read all this, but basically what it now says is that under two circumstances, it is ethically acceptable to use placebo controls when there are compelling methodological reasons for the use of placebo, or when using placebo is for a minor condition and is not going to subject subjects to any serious risks of harm. I think that "or" there should really be "and." And not really a note of clarification because it's inconsistent with Principle 29, showing that there's an incoherence now in thinking about the ethics of placebo-controlled trials. So now I'm going to turn more directly to that debate. So I'm going to talk to you about two arguments against the use of placebo-controlled trials. The first is the argument from the therapeutic obligation of physicians, which invokes the principle of clinical equipoise. The second is the argument from scientific or clinical merit. Now, both of these arguments have a great deal of intuitive plausibility, but I'm going to argue that they are both have problems, and they're mistaken insofar as they suggest that it's never acceptable to use placebo controls despite proving effective treatment. So turning first to the argument from the therapeutic obligation. And this argument goes like this. Use of placebo controls when proven effective treatments exist violates the duty of physicians to offer their patients optimal medical care. And therefore, when a standard treatment has already been proven better than placebo, it's unethical to test an investigational treatment against placebo, which is inferior to the standard treatment. And the key principle here is known as clinical equipoise. And this holds that randomized controlled trials are ethical only if there is a state of uncertainty in the expert medical community about the relative therapeutic value of the investigational and the controlled treatments as well as the standard of care. And underlying this is the norm that no patient should be randomized to a treatment known to be inferior. Now I'm going to try to suggest concretely what the problems are with the therapeutic obligation standard and equipoise by looking at one particular trial. It's a trial of St. John's Wort, which compared this herbal remedy to sertraline or Zoloft and placebo in treating major depression. This was a trial sponsored by the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, as well as the NIMH. And St. John's Wort had already been shown to be superior to placebo in mild depression, and Zoloft, being a standard treatment, had been shown to be superior to placebo in several trials for major depression and was FDA was approved by the FDA. So there was equipoise between St. John's Wort and sertraline. That is, no one knew which one might be better or they might be the same for treating major depression, but there wasn't equipoise between sertraline and placebo. And so therefore the use of placebo randomized patients to a treatment known to be inferior, namely to a placebo arm. And so the question arises, is this an unethical trial? The critics of these kinds of trials argue that what we need here is not a placebo-controlled trial, but an active-controlled trial that just compares St. John's Wort with sertraline. So I'm going to argue that the problem with appeal to the therapeutic obligation in randomized trials and to this doctrine of clinical equipoise is that they confuse and conflate the ethics of clinical trials with the ethics of medical care. And there are some very important distinctions that we need to bear in mind between clinical trials and medical care. Important differences in the purpose of the activities, in the characteristic methods that are used in these two activities, and very importantly, in the way that we justify risks. So the purpose of randomized trials is to produce generalizable knowledge about the effectiveness of treatment and safety by controlled experimentation in groups of patients with the aim of promoting improved medical care. And this is in fundamental contrast with the goal of medical care, which is to provide personalized care for particular patients. So I stress here the contrast between the group focus of randomized trials and the particular patient-centered focus of medical care. These activities are really quite different. The purpose of randomized trials is not to determine what treatment is best for the particular patients who are in the trial. In terms of the methods, randomized trials include methods such as randomization, of course, blinding, that is, neither the patient subjects nor the investigators will often know which treatment the subjects are receiving. Sometimes there is the use of placebos, and quite typically these trials are governed by a protocol which restricts the flexibility of treatment to the patients, and also there are research procedures in the trials that are specifically for the purpose of measuring study outcomes, not for the benefit of the subjects. And these methods employed to answer scientific questions are quite foreign to the ethos of medical care. That is, doctors don't flip a coin in providing treatment. They select particular treatments for patients. They know what treatment is being given to the patient. They don't use placebos. Typically, there will be a flexibility in the treatment of the patient so that as the patient's responses change, treatments will also change rather than following a fixed protocol. And then in terms of the justification of risks, randomized trials are composed of a number of procedures for scientific purposes that carry risks of discomfort or harm to the subjects, but without a prospect of benefit to them. These are procedures such as lumbar punctures, biopsies, imaging procedures using radiation, which are employed either to confirm the diagnosis and typically to measure study outcomes. And these procedures are justified by the anticipated value of the knowledge from the trial, not by any benefit to the subjects. Whereas in contrast, in medical care, the risks of diagnostic and treatment interventions are justified by the potential medical benefits to the patients. So there's a very basic difference. That is, in medical care, we only justify risks by benefits to patients, whereas in clinical research in general and clinical trials in particular, there are procedures involved which are not for the benefit of the subjects, but are justified by the value of the knowledge to be gained. So given these very basic differences between clinical research and medical care, I think it follows that the obligations of clinical investigators are not the same as the obligations of physicians in clinical practice. And specifically, investigators have a duty to avoid harming or exploiting research subjects. They do not have a therapeutic duty to provide optimal medical care. And it's also important to recognize that the need for uncertainty in justifying the conduct of a randomized trial is not the same as the principle that patients should never be randomized to treatment known to be inferior. There must be uncertainty about whether the investigational treatment is better than placebo. But it doesn't follow that placebo is unethical when proven effective treatments exist. So, in other words, we need to distinguish the uncertainty principle, which is a necessary methodological principle, from the no inferior treatment principle. And there has to be uncertainty about the hypothesis to be tested in a trial. But it doesn't follow that it's always wrong to use placebo when proven effective treatments are there. To carry this one step further, let's consider a placebo-controlled trial of a new treatment for allergic rhinitis. So there are several proven effective treatments for this condition. And to randomize patient subjects to placebo in a trial for this condition means that you're going to expose the patient subjects in the placebo arm to the risks of the symptoms of untreated allergic rhinitis: sneezing, running nose, and itching eyes. For the duration of the trial. And it's actually difficult to see what the problem is in exposing subjects to the risks of these minor symptoms for a relatively short period of time. And if that's the case, I think that this suggests a rather fundamental point, that what counts ethically in evaluating placebo controls is not the denial of treatment, but the risk of harm and exploitation of participants by being randomized to placebo. And I put denial here in quotation marks because I think that when you're enrolling subjects in a clinical trial with their informed consent and they agree to be exposed to placebo, then you're really denying them on treatment. So in the St. John's Wort trial, what counts is whether the risks of being randomized to placebo and thus to go without treatment for major depression for the duration of the trial, does that expose subjects to unreasonable risks of harm when they are being carefully monitored by the investigators? So now turning to the argument from scientific merit. So that when proven effective treatments exist, it is argued that there isn't any clinical or scientific value in testing an investigational treatment against placebo. What we want to know is whether the investigational treatment is as good or better than the standard treatment, not whether it's better than nothing. Now, this seems to have a good deal of plausibility, but is it true? Well, first of all, the double-blind placebo-controlled trial is widely considered to be the most rigorous test of treatment of treatments. And what the double-blind placebo-controlled trial does is allow one to evaluate whether there are specific pharmacological properties of a treatment that are responsible for patients getting better, as distinct from non-pharmacological conditions such as the natural history of the disorder or the placebo response. And so to test symptomatic treatments for many chronic conditions, there are very strong methodological reasons in favor of placebo-controlled trials. Now, there are a variety of conditions that favor the use of placebo-controlled trials. These are conditions which have a fluctuating symptoms. Often a spontaneous remission is a possibility of the disorder. These are conditions that have high rates of placebo response. In major depression, the placebo response rate in randomized trials is around 30%. It's even higher in irritable bowel syndrome, around 43%. These conditions are characterized by existing treatments that work, but they don't necessarily work all that well or work for all patients. And what we also find is that the standard treatments, even those that are approved by the FDA, are not consistently superior to placebo in placebo-controlled trials. So there are some very distinctive methodological problems with active control trials, which is the basic alternative to placebo-controlled trials. And these problems are particularly acute with trials to demonstrate the equivalence or so-called non-inferiority of two treatments. Now, if you have an active controlled trial which is aimed at testing superiority, that is, you're trying to show that an investigational treatment is superior to a standard treatment, if indeed you find a statistically significant difference between the investigational treatment and the standard treatment, and if that difference is clinically relevant, then you have produced valid and valuable knowledge. There aren't any methodological problems with superiority trials. However, if you are now looking to see whether an investigational and standard treatment are equivalent, or that the investigational treatment is not inferior to the standard treatment, and in point of fact, you find that there's no statistically significant difference between the investigational and the standard treatment, you're faced with two conclusions. Either both the investigational treatment and the standard treatment were effective, in the trial, or neither the investigational treatment nor the standard treatment was effective. And if you don't have a placebo control, it's going to be very difficult to discern which conclusion is correct. Going back to the St. John's Wort trial, an active controlled equivalence trial of St. John's Wort versus sertraline would pose problems of internal validity or assay sensitivity. That is, if one found no difference between the two, it would be very difficult to tell whether they both worked or neither worked. And furthermore, it's worthwhile to determine if St. John's Wort is better than placebo, despite the demonstrated efficacy of standard antidepressants. This is a widely used herbal treatment. We don't know whether it works, and so there's significant public health value in finding out whether it does work, and the best way to find that out is to test it against placebo. And in point of fact, in this particular trial, neither St. John's Wort nor Zoloft had superior efficacy to placebo, and it was a fairly decently sized trial, at least for the psychiatric area. And if there were no placebo control in this trial, and what was found that there was no difference, no detected difference between the two, then it might have been concluded that St. John's Wort is effective in treating major depression and equivalent to sertraline. So I think you can see that having a placebo in that trial made a very important difference in being able to interpret the results. So there are some distinctive benefits of placebo-controlled trials. First, one gets stronger internal validity than active control equivalence trials, particularly in conditions with high rates of placebo response. And they're more efficient. That is, you typically will need fewer subjects to test whether an experimental treatment is better than a placebo than you will to test whether that experimental treatment is equivalent to a standard treatment or better than a standard treatment. And that's because we can expect that the difference between an experimental treatment and placebo is smaller than the difference between that treatment, excuse me, and a standard treatment. And if it's is larger, that is, you can expect that there will be a larger difference than between the experimental treatment and placebo than the experimental treatment and a standard treatment. And if you can expect a larger difference, then you need a smaller sample size. And this is ethically relevant because that means you can expose fewer subjects to a potentially ineffective investigational treatment or one that has toxicity. Also, placebo-controlled trials help in determining whether adverse events or side effects that are detected are due to the treatment itself or the underlying condition. And it's not often, particularly in chronic conditions, it can be difficult to determine which is the case. And when you have a placebo control, it's easier to detect that. Now, all these reasons all these considerations give you strong reasons for preferring placebo-controlled trials, but still we have to ask the question whether it's ethical to expose subjects to no treatment in a randomized trial when proven effective treatment does exist. So it might be argued that ethical norms should really trump these methodological considerations, that what I've set up here is science versus ethics, and when we put it that way, obviously ethics should win. Now, I think this is a false dichotomy here. Scientific validity of clinical research is a fundamental ethical protection. A subject should be exposed to risks in a study that lacks scientific validity. And so these methodological considerations in favor of placebo-controlled trials and against active control equivalence trials are ethically relevant. So now I want to turn to pointing out some of the ethical criteria for justifying placebo-controlled trials when proven effective effective treatments exist. That is, there are good reasons in some conditions for using placebo controls, but we have to be concerned about the level of risks to which subjects are being exposed, and we have to be concerned about whether they understand what's going on in the trial. So the most important criteria is that there must be a scientific merit and clinical value in the trial using a placebo control, that the risks to subjects are not going to be serious or excessive, that there are adequate safeguards in place to minimize the risks to subjects, and there is a scrupulous process of informed consent. I'm going to talk about each of these. So scientific merit. The placebo-controlled trial should not be conducted if it isn't needed to answer a valuable research question or to assure the scientific validity of a scientifically valuable study. That is, so is it necessary to use placebo to answer the question, and is the question valuable? And furthermore, institutional IRBs, research and ethics committees, should require a detailed scientific justification of placebo controls. That is, one shouldn't just presume that because it's a gold standard, it's always okay to use placebo. There has to be a distinctive rationale about why you need a placebo control to answer the scientific question of the trial. Very important, of course, is the risk-benefit assessment of randomizing subjects to placebo. The risks of placebo, and these are the risks from withholding treatment, must be minor or at least not severe. We shouldn't be inviting patients into trials where we expect them to be exposed to some harm to their health or to very strong and persisting discomfort. Whatever risks that there are from being exposed to placebo, the value of the knowledge to be gained from the trial must be sufficient to justify these risks. So we do actually have some data on some systematic data on the risks to subjects trials of major depression. And so several years ago, there was a large-scale meta-analysis done of the FDA a database of trials of antidepressants, which encompassed thousands of patients. The risks that we should be most concerned about in major depression is suicide or attempted suicide. And it was found that those randomized to placebo are not at a statistically significantly greater risk of suicide or attempted suicide. Indeed, if there's any greater risk, it's in the drug arm rather than in the placebo arm. It was found in this large data set that the mean reduction of symptoms of depression on placebo was 31% versus 41% for both investigational and standard drugs. Now, in thousands of patients, this is a highly statistically significant difference, but it's not a very large difference. It's only 10%. And I think the most important lesson here is that on average, depressed patients randomized to placebo get better, not worse. It's just that they don't sustain, on average, the same level of improvement as those on drug. So there are a range of important safeguards for minimizing the risks in placebo-controlled trials. First, one needs to exclude subjects who can be predicted at higher risk of clinical deterioration. It's desirable to have the shortest duration of a trial that's necessary to test the study hypothesis. So you don't have anyone on placebo any longer than you need to in order to answer the question. Very importantly, one needs careful procedures for monitoring the subjects. As the risks go up, these procedures need to be more rigorous. In some trials, it's desirable to have the study done inpatient, so subjects can be carefully monitored all the time. Rescue medications need to be available in response to symptom exacerbation. So in a placebo-controlled trial of depression, if people get anxious during the trial or they have difficulty sleeping, typically there will be some procedure within the protocol that those conditions can be treated. And very importantly, there need to be reasonable criteria for stopping the participation of a particular subject in case of adverse events. So one way that can be done is set up a priori criteria for how much symptom worsening you're going to tolerate in subjects before you take them out of the trial and give them treatment. In a number of the placebo-controlled trials that are done here in NIMH, there will often be a criterion of 30% symptom worsening, which will trigger at least a careful consideration of whether the trial should continue for that patient or the patient should be taken out of the trial and given standard treatment. So turning to informed consent. First of all, we need to assure the capability of subjects enrolled in placebo-controlled trials to give informed consent. And here we run up against the problem known as the therapeutic misconception. And that is, despite accurate disclosures to patient subjects about randomization and the use of placebo controls, several studies have found that patient subjects believe that the treatments that they're getting in a randomized trial have been selected for them based on a clinical judgment of what's best for them. And so there is this tendency to confuse the context of medical care with a very different context of clinical research. And in order to assure informed consent, we need to be able to guard against that. So there are a variety of aspects of participating in research that, particularly where there are placebo controls, that participants need to understand in order to give informed consent. First of all, of course, they need to understand that they're participating in research. It's not just medical care. It's something different going on. They need to know the nature of the study, what its purpose is, and what the major features are of study design that have an impact on them. Importantly, they need to understand the meaning of placebo. Just to tell people that they're getting a placebo doesn't mean that they really know what that means, and the rationale in lay terms for its use, why it's important to use a placebo rather than just standard treatment as a control. They need to understand that treatment is being given to them in a random way, not based on any judgment of what's best for them. They need to understand that neither they nor the investigators will know what treatment they are receiving during the study. Very importantly, patient subjects need to understand that there's some risks of symptom worsening, particularly if they're assigned to placebo, and also a risk of a relative lack of improvement as compared to what they might have gotten if they were on a standard drug. And they need to understand the alternatives to participation in the trial. If this is a placebo-controlled trial, despite proven effective treatments, and there are clinically available treatments for the patients that they can get outside the trial, and they need to understand that. And in general, I think it's very important, given the ethically distinctive differences between clinical research and medical care, it's very important that subjects understand that by being enrolled in a clinical trial, they're doing something very different than standard medical treatment, that the purpose of this is to generate knowledge to improve the future care of patients. The purpose is not to determine what treatment is best for them. So in conclusion, determining when placebo controls when placebo controls are justified depends on recognizing these ethically relevant differences between clinical trials and medical care. And placebo-controlled trials are often methodologically indicated and are not necessarily unethical when proven effective treatments exist for the condition under study. And justifying placebo-controlled trials despite the existence of proven effective treatments requires a very thorough process of risk-benefit assessment, scrupulous informed consent, and careful monitoring of subjects. Thank you very much. So I think we have time for some questions.
Frank, I take away from this that the situations where this is a reasonable alternative is situations where the pre-existing treatment has marginal efficacy. If one were to take a study of some new analgesic for strong pain, where you do have opioids which have a 70 to 90% chance of relieving severe pain, and so we've got a new drug, we'd like to put this up against placebo. Through this structure, would that be ethically appropriate or possible at any, or ethically appropriate?
Right. Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think it really depends on what do we know about the existing treatments. That is, if they're effective, 70% of the time, then we have a much greater confidence that they're going to work in the trial, and then we don't have to be as concerned about those methodological problems which I pointed out. And then there's also the severity of the symptoms to which subjects are going to be exposed if they're on placebo. So if one can anticipate that one's going to have very acute, strong pain, then that's something that I don't think would be tolerable in a placebo-controlled trial. But that might be quite a bit different from a trial testing a new treatment for headaches or osteoarthritis of the knee. So I think it's very situation-specific. What's the nature of the condition and the symptoms that subjects are likely to experience if on placebo? And what do we know about the efficacy and the consistency of the efficacy of standard treatments? And so we're going to get a different answer depending on the condition and the state of knowledge about treatments.
And the second question is, can one always dichotomize between the roles between research and clinical care? Because a lot of research is actually carried out in the context of clinical care.
Okay. Well, I don't think you can always, I mean, I don't really want to draw a dichotomy here, but I want to say that there's a distinction. That is, I don't want to say that the roles are so different that there's no overlapping at all. I think there's a great deal of it. But, even when the overlapping is so pervasive, that it's still, I think, always important to understand what's being done to someone, because for research purposes, and what's being done to them for clinical care. And so I think that the distinction is always important, even though, of course, particularly as we're dealing with sicker patients, one can't divorce their clinical care, because they have a lot of medical needs, from conducting a trial. But even so, there are always important differences between the two activities, and we really need to bear those in mind so we can be clear what we're doing, whether it's for clinical purposes or for research purposes, and how we're going to justify the risks that subjects are being exposed to.
You mentioned that there are criteria for trial discontinuation in the placebo.
Maybe you can get a little bit closer.
You mentioned that there are criteria for trial discontinuation in placebo-controlled trials.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, do they apply equally to the active arm of the trials, and might this affect the scientific validity of the placebo-controlled trial?
Yeah. Well, the answer is yes. I mean, you need to be concerned about people getting worse, no matter what arm they're in. And, of course, if it's a double-blind trial, you won't know which arm they're in. And also, sure, we're doing clinical research with human subjects. So that always means that we're subject to some compromise of scientific validity. I mean, what you can do in the laboratory with mice is one thing, and what you can do with human subjects is something else. I mean, and so, and, you know, the very fact that we have to get informed consent, that we have to carefully monitor subjects and be concerned about their welfare means that we're going to tolerate some degree of potential compromise of scientific validity, either by not enrolling certain subjects in a trial and therefore raising some concern about selection bias, or taking subjects out, perhaps, you know, being worried about, you know, not sufficient power. So that's kind of just goes with the territory.
I had a question about the basically the scientific validity of placebo-controlled trials, specifically the example you used of how it might be that even if you do just an active control trial, you won't be able to tell between whether or not the two treatments are both effective or both ineffective. Mm-hmm. But it seems, I thought, one of the requirements for placebo-controlled trials was that, you know, you would have, one of the requirements of active control, one of the reasons for active control trials was that you knew one of the two treatments was more effective than no treatment or standard treatment. One of the two treatments was going to be more effective. So that would mean that if you were running this trial and it turned out that the placebo was just as effective as those two things you were testing as the St. John's Wort case, that would be actually quite a surprise, because I thought that the part of the preconditions for these active control trials was that you would basically not know, or that you would certainly know that if one, the one that you're testing is equal to the other one, since you know the other one is better than standard treatment, then, you know, the one you're testing must be better.
Well, it may seem like a paradox, but the problem is that many of our treatments work, but they don't work consistently, and they don't work for all patients. So the fact that in the St. John's Wort trial you have a proven effective treatment, which was a comparator to St. John's Wort along with placebo, that might make you think, well, it's proven effective. So if we don't find any difference between St. John's Wort and Zoloft, that means that they both work. Well, the problem is that that standard treatments for depression do not consistently work in randomized trials. Now, if we did trials of, you know, multiple thousands of patient subjects, then we really would have a strong expectation that the standard treatment would work, but we can't actually run trials of that large. So in any given feasible trial, there remains some uncertainty about whether that standard treatment is going to work in the trial. And since you want, you know, to have your trial have as much internal validity as possible, that's what the placebo control gives you. We're not talking about antibiotics, say, for treating bacterial infections, where one can be confident that, you know, a very high percentage of the time you're going to get a cure. Here we're talking about symptomatic treatments that work for many but not all patients and not consistently. And we're also talking about conditions that are quite responsive to placebo. And so the anticipated difference between drug and placebo may be small, and that's why you really need a control.
Hi. I was just wondering if you have any views about how to improve participants' understanding. Because it seems like we have a situation in which you have full or standard disclosure, you have competent participants, and yet still you have the therapeutic misconception. And so I was just wondering whether you have any views about, one, how to improve it, and two, even if you don't, does it put an unnecessary burden on the researcher? Now they have to not just disclose, but they have to make sure that the participant fully understands.
Well, that's a good question. And I'm glad you asked it, because I had forgotten to mention one point I wanted to make when I was talking about informed consent. And that is, in light of this therapeutic misconception, in terms of which we know that a significant proportion of patient subjects are going to be confused about what's going on in a placebo-controlled trial, even though they're told it's randomized, you're going to get placebo, or you have a chance of getting placebo. And so I think one valuable measure to put in place is some kind of test of comprehension for those key elements that I listed that participants need to know. I think it could be done in a fairly simple way. And if the trial involves a placebo and one anticipates more than minor risk from withholding treatment, then I think it may even be required to have a test of comprehension in some level, so that if subjects can't pass it, then they need to be re-educated about those key points of the trial so that they can pass the test. This, of course, does impose a certain greater burden on investigators. But I think if we want to allow investigators to randomize patient subjects to placebo when there is a proven effective treatment out there, because there are good methodological reasons to do so, then I think we need to go the extra mile to be as confident as we can about informed consent.
Frank, I wanted to, you made a compelling case for methodological reasons that argue in favor of using placebo in certain trials. I wonder if you could comment on the, I think, more controversial idea that placebo-controlled trials are sometimes okay when an effective drug is effective but not available, right, either because of cost or some other reason.
Well, of course, that is particularly thorny. And it's been most discussed in the international setting where developed countries, sponsor placebo-controlled trials in less developed countries, where they wouldn't conduct those kinds of trials back home because of the availability of typically an expensive or a sort of clinically rigorous course of treatment that's not available in the less developed country. And it seems to me that if the research is really designed to produce clinically relevant knowledge for that population, which, say, is not going to be able to afford the more expensive treatment, but might be able to afford a less expensive, possibly less effective treatment, then I think there are very good reasons for a placebo-controlled trial under those conditions, because it isn't going to be realistic. Even if you could do an active controlled trial that compared, say, a less expensive investigational treatment to an already expensive, proven, effective treatment, you're still going to need to know whether that less expensive treatment actually works for this population under their conditions. I think you're going to need to test it against placebo. So, of course, it's controversial, but the considerations are somewhat different. Because in those cases, you could say, that the lack of availability of a standard treatment could involve actually very serious risk, as opposed to what would happen if people had the expensive standard treatment. But I think you've got to be concerned about the context in which you're working.
Thank you very much. Okay, now we're going to turn from design issues to issues of certain populations. And our next speaker is going to talk about ethical issues in research with children. And to do that with us today is Dr. Lainey Ross, who is the Carolyn and Matthew Buxbaum Professor of Clinical Ethics at the University of Chicago School of Medicine, and has written extensively on the ethics of pediatric research. Lainey? This is your forward and backward, and this is the best pointer.
Good morning. And thank you for this invitation. So, yes, today I'm going to talk about ethical issues in research with children. We will readdress, I promise, the placebo issue from a different perspective. But the question I really want to address today is, what is the morally appropriate role for children in research? What we'll see is that the historical overview is that the earliest guidelines were written to protect against child abuse. But with the miracles of modern medicine, the more recent guidelines have actually sought to increase access for the participation of children in research. And I would say our goal for this century ought to be to strike the proper balance, that the pendulum may have swung too far. So here's a interesting quote to start the day. The history of pediatric experimentation is largely one of child abuse. And this comes from an introduction to a book entitled Children as Research Subjects by Lederer and Grodin. And what they were basically looking at was research on immunization, which often used child subjects because they needed people who were naive, who had never been exposed to the disease. And what they pointed out is, when you look at the history of looking at infectious disease research in the 18th century, the typical subject was child subjects were the researcher's own children, servants, or slaves. But by the 19th century, the child subjects were often institutionalized children in order to get more similar to that lab rat that Dr. Miller just mentioned. And by the 20th century, in fact, the subjects, while it included the researcher, the researcher's children, and institutionalized persons, there was also a focus on institutionalized persons with cognitive impairment. And here was one explanation for why the choice to use institutionalized children. Quote, research on institutionalized children offers scientific advantages because the standardized conditions in the asylum approximated those, quote, conditions which are insisted on in considering the course of experimentation infection among lab animals, but which can rarely be controlled in a study of infection in man. So if you have an institutionalized individual, whether it's because they're institutionalized for cognitive impairment or even in a prison, you have the value of, you can determine what their diet is, how many hours of sunshine they get, how many hours of sleep they get, et cetera, et cetera. You can approximate that lab animal. Another reason for using children at the turn of the 20th century was they were cheaper than calves. So clearly not very good reasons for using kids. Post-World War II, we get the Nuremberg Code, which actually, when you look at it, it doesn't address research with children. The first principle is that the informed consent of the voluntary subject is necessary. It's actually not until the Declaration of Helsinki in the 1960s that we start acknowledging that if we're going to do research on individuals who cannot consent for themselves, we need the concept of surrogate decision-making. 2 years after the Declaration of Helsinki is published a very important article by Henry Beecher called Ethics in Clinical Research. And in this paper, Dr. Beecher described 22 studies, four involving children, which he said were unethical. They were all done after World War II. He was a gentleman. He didn't give names, but he gave you enough information so that you would agree that these studies were unethical. Well, now in the era of Google, you can figure out exactly what those 22 articles are, or you can just go to Rothman's book, Stranger at the Bedside, and in the appendix, it'll give you the 22 studies, where they were published, the authors, et cetera. But the point of it was to say, just because we have these regulations doesn't mean we're actually actively protecting children. And so what happened after Beecher, after Tuskegee, after all of this, is that we start getting guidelines that focus on protecting subjects, particularly vulnerable populations like children. So we get, for example, the first American guidelines for the protection of children in 1977 with the publication of the National Commission Report on Children, research involving children, and those will actually go into guidelines in 1983. At the same time, we have the American Academy of Pediatrics designing when children can participate, for example, in drug research. The National Commission Report is interesting because it acknowledges the tension that we need to protect children, but we also need to do research with children, otherwise we can't advance pediatric medicine. And so the report begins with a justification. The Commission recognizes the importance of safeguarding and improving the health and well-being of children because they deserve the best care that society can reasonably provide, and yet at the same time acknowledging ethical problems arise from the dependence and immaturity of children, which can be offset by establishing conditions that research must satisfy. Nevertheless, the National Commission and the federal regulations almost take the National Commission recommendation verbatim. Look at, when can children participate? Well, the research must be scientifically sound and significant. where appropriate, the studies have first been conducted on animals, on adult humans, then on older children. In other words, take those who can give the adult human informed consent before getting surrogate consent, that the risks are minimized by using the safest procedures consistent with sound research design, that adequate provisions are made to protect the privacy of the child and parents, that subjects will be selected in an equitable or fair manner, and that there are adequate provisions for the permission of the parents and, when appropriate, the assent of the child. This is very different than adult research. In a sense, in adult research, if you have a consenting adult, if you explain the risks and benefits, and the research is scientifically sound, the research can be performed. In pediatrics, there's a real emphasis on risks and benefits. So in pediatric research, the guidelines will actually give sort of the maximal amount of risk that children are allowed to take. And the only exception for that is when there's the prospect of direct benefit. And as I said, the federal regulations almost take the National Commission report verbatim. It's the only national commission that actually had the authority to write regulations. Shift 20 years, so we have these guidelines then in the 70s and 80s that are focusing on protection. In the 1990s and in the last decade, the policies actually have focused on promoting access for all research participants, including children and other vulnerable populations. And what type of policies is this? In 1997, we have FDAMA, the Food and Drug Administration Modernization Act, which actually gave incentives for including research with children. This was reauthorized under the BPCA in 2002. In 1998, the NIH started telling external researchers that if you want all NIH research must include children unless you can give an adequate justification for why it's appropriate to exclude them. We also have passage in 2003 of the Pediatric Research Equity Act, in some ways where FDAMA and the BPCA are the carrot, and they basically say if you do research on children, we'll give you an extra 6 months of exclusivity so that you'll actually be able to make a lot more money on these drugs. The Pediatric Research Equity Act was sort of the stick, which said that in order to justify the participation of children, in order to get drugs approved, you need to include pediatric subjects as well. So lots of policy changes that are promoting access. So why the shift? Well, one big concern was that children were therapeutic orphans. The fact is you just can't take an adult dose and say, well, the child weighs half of what an adult weighs, so we'll give half an adult, because children aren't just short adults. They actually metabolize drugs very differently, and so we just can't downsize our medications. The other reason for the real shift from protection to access is the success, for example, with HIV therapies. The AIDS epidemic, at the time, the only people who were surviving the AIDS epidemic in the 80s were those who were in therapeutic trials. And all of a sudden, people stopped worrying about ensuring the fair distribution of risks in research, but now focusing on ensuring the fair distribution of benefits from research. And if we're going to fairly share the benefits of research, then why aren't we including children as well? And so this change from focus on protecting from risk to moving to benefits, I'm going to suggest is misfocused, and I'll actually suggest that Dr. Miller proved that to us in the fact that he pointed out how different the researchers' obligations and perspective is and ought to be versus the clinical physicians, so that this notion of focusing on the benefits, in a sense, is misguided. I'm going to do what Beecher did. Beecher gave 22, but unlike Beecher, I'm going to give you names and titles so you can just check on anything I say. The world has changed. If I didn't tell it to you, you'd be able to locate it on Google anyway. But I'm going to begin with one with a literary example. So how many of you remember the story of Curious George Gets a Medal? Oh, we have an illiterate bunch here, Dr. Grady. This is a really important book. It's probably the only book that our vice presidential candidate of one party ought to be considered banning. But this is a book that's worth considering. So Curious George gets a letter. And he gets a letter, and all of a sudden he realized, I don't know how to read. But he decides he's going to answer the letter anyway. So he gets out a pen, and this is Curious George. It was written in the 50s, so he gets out an ink pen, and he tries to get the ink out, and the ink spills all over the table. So then he goes and gets soap and water, and he pours it out, and he floods the entire house. So he realized the only way to clean up before the man with the yellow hat comes home is to get a pump. The neighbor has a pump. That's that blue thing in the back there. But he can't carry it. It's too heavy. So he borrows the neighbor's cow. And the neighbor sees him stealing his cow and his pump. And he gets really upset. So the neighbor starts chasing him, and George gets scared, and he jumps onto a passing truck. The truck happens to be going to the Museum of Science and Industry. And he gets into the Museum of Science and Industry, and he sees this beautiful exhibit of Africa with coconut trees. And again, remember, George can't read, so he doesn't see the sign which says this is fake, and he doesn't see the sign which says please do not climb. And he climbs to get one of the coconuts. The whole exhibit collapses, and the guards catch him and put him in a cage and bring him to the director's office. At the same time, the man with the yellow hat comes to the Museum of Science and Industry because the letter that George received had actually come from the director. And here's what the letter said. Dear George, a small spaceship has been built by our experimental station. It is too small for a man but could carry a little monkey. Would you be willing to go up in it? I've never met you, so we're trying to get him to participate in research, right? I've never met you, but I hear that you are a bright little monkey who can do all sorts of things, and that's just what we need. So if you want to enroll somebody in research, flatter them. Okay. We want you to do something nobody has ever done before. Bail out of a spaceship in flight. So this will be the first individual to participate. And here's what the research methodology is. When we flash you a signal, you will have to open the door and bail out with the help of emergency rockets. And then it says, we hope that you are willing and that your friend will permit you to go. So now we're asking for parental permission and the child's assent. Gratefully yours, Professor Wiseman. What is this consent form missing? We talked about the methods. What? Risks. It's missing a description of the risks. Exactly. Well, here's what next happens when Professor Wiseman realizes the man with the yellow hat who says, George, what are you doing in that cage? Here's Professor Wiseman's response. So you are George, Professor Wiseman said. If I had only known. Of course, everything will be forgiven if you are willing to go. A little bit of coercion to participate? Well, anyway, how the story ends is that George has explained that when he goes up in the rocket, and they flash the light, he has to open the emergency doors and bail out. They flash it. He tries to pull the emergency exit. Doesn't work. They flash the light again. He tries to open the door. It doesn't work. At which point, Professor Wiseman's mumbling under his breath, he has to get out soon or we're going to run out of oxygen. Oops, one of those risks we forgot to mention. Anyway, they press the light again. He tries to open the door, it succeeds, and he parachutes down, and as the title of the book foretells, George gets a medal. But that's the wrong lesson of this book. The real lessons are, one, illiteracy makes you a vulnerable subject. Two, informed consent documents should describe the risks as well as the benefits. Three, subjects may feel coerced for many reasons. Of course, all will be forgiven as long as you agree to go. And number four, is that an experiment is ethical at its inception, that the ends don't justify the means. It doesn't matter whether the research is successful or not. It should be ethical when you enroll in the participation. This, again, coming from Beecher's famous article in 1966. But let me focus now and move and shift to some real research that has enrolled children. One of my complaints about the Curious George story is George is supposed to be the child, and he is the first one to go up in a spaceship. The question is, when is it appropriate for children to be the first participants in research? And here's this case study that I'm going to use that was published last year in the Journal of the AMA. And the objective of this study was to determine the safety and metabolic effects of high-dose immunosuppression followed by an autologous non-myeloablative hematopoietic stem cell transplant. So basically, in newly diagnosed type 1 diabetes. So we're going to take type 1 diabetics, give them high-dose immunosuppression, wipe out their bone marrow, then give them a hematopoietic stem cell transplant and see if this doesn't treat type 1 diabetes and prevent its return. So what you have to know is a little bit about history of what medications have worked, actually, with type 1 diabetes. And one thing you should know is that we know that high-dose immunosuppression will actually stop the symptoms of diabetes, but high-dose immunosuppression leads to increased risk of infection, to malignancy, and has so many serious side effects that we wouldn't use it for that purpose alone. So the study here, though, is it's a prospective phase 1-2 study of 15 patients with type 1 diabetes, ranging from the ages of 14 to 31, who were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes within the previous 6 weeks. The enrollment went over a 3-year period in Brazil. The patients, the first patient actually was diagnosed with diabetic ketoacidosis and did quite poorly. So after that, they changed the enrollment that you had to present with type 1 diabetes but not actually be in diabetic ketoacidosis. After that, you had your own stem cells were collected. You then received this high-dose immunosuppression, and then your own bone marrow was given back to you. And then you were also given cyclophosphamide and ATG therapy. So I'm going to ask 4 questions. Was the study design ethical? And particularly one of the questions is, did the study need a control group? Now, in general, when we do phase 1 and phase 2 research, we don't include a control group because all we're trying to prove is safety and efficacy. The problem here is that the pre-treatment, so the real question of this study is bone marrow transplantation effective in treating type 1 diabetes? The problem is the pre-treatment, which is high-dose cyclophosphamide, has been known to treat type 1 diabetes for up to a year. And since that was the follow-up period, the question is, if you don't have a control group, you don't know whether it's the cyclophosphamide that's actually improving their symptoms or if it's actually the bone marrow transplant. So it means that you really can't answer the scientific question. And as Dr. Miller suggested in the first talk, then that's not scientifically valid. That's one question. The next question is, does it matter that Dr. Burt was from the U.S., but he partnered with colleagues in Brazil, and none from his own institution nor his own country, and in fact, all the subjects come from Brazil? So the question, this will start raising the issue of when is it ethical to do research outside of the U.S., gets very complicated, but at least one of the things most people will agree is we should be doing research outside of the U.S. when the research will most likely benefit individuals in that country. This is a very expensive treatment, requires very high-tech medicine, probably will not be offered in Brazil for many years to come, even if found effective. And the third question, then, is was the subject selection appropriate? Should we have begun with children, or should we remember our own federal regulations, which basically said, when possible, do it on adults first before enrolling children? And so I would actually say that just like Curious George shouldn't have been the first to go up in space, that clearly the first subjects in this study should not have been children. So when is it appropriate for children to be in research? 1, when it represents the best medical option. 2, when we already have phase 1 and phase 2 studies in adults that show safety and a promise of efficacy, so it makes sense to start enrolling children. And 3, when the study is designed to include subset analyses. And what I mean by that is there were 15 subjects. And at the end of the day, even if we thought that this was a promising treatment, we don't know if it's actually promising in children. We only know that it may be promising for all subjects, all comers. And that becomes a very important example, and I'll use asthma, actually, to explain that right after I finish with this slide. And the reason I'm going to do that is because one of my concerns is if we're not doing subset analysis, we're exposing children to risk without getting that group benefit that Dr. Miller talked about generalizability of information for the group of vulnerable subjects, namely children. And that if we're enrolling children, there should be a potential for benefiting pediatric medicine. So here's the case I want to use. I'm going to look at clinical asthma trials. I want to look at the issues of equipoise, the use of placebos, and when research morally can enroll children. So a little bit of background on asthma. It's one of the most common chronic conditions of childhood. Over 4.5 million children in the U.S. are affected, accounting for over 10 million missed school days, 5.8 million outpatient visits, over 867,000 emergency department visits, 174,000 hospitalizations, and over 200 deaths annually in children. So this is not a mild condition like allergic rhinitis. This is a very serious condition with over 200 deaths annually. The NHLBI actually developed guidelines in 1991. These guidelines are about 10 years delayed from the European experience. There was a lot more knowledge about this in the 80s in Europe than it was in this country. But in 1991, our guidelines were very clear that anti-inflammatory medications is needed for all children and adults with more than mild asthma. And the preferred drug at that time was inhaled corticosteroids for children and adults with severe asthma. inhaled corticosteroids for adults with moderate asthma, but because we were still concerned a little bit about safety, we decided that for children, we would just use something like Cromolyn, so an anti-inflammatory but non-steroidal. In 1997, and in 2002, and in fact in 2007, these guidelines have been affirmed, with the only change that now with greater safety data, inhaled corticosteroids is recommended as the first-line therapy for all children and adults with more than mild intermittent asthma. So that's the standard of care. I give you the 1991 guidelines because I'm going to be looking at studies that were done in 1998 through 2001. And to be fair to them, we need to say that a study probably was designed in the early 1990s. The study was done, and then the results were reported. It was accepted by a journal. That could be a six-year period. So an article that was published in 1998 should clearly be in conformance with the guidelines of 1991. And here was the study objective. We asked, how often do children enrolled in clinical asthma trials receive the anti-inflammatory medicine in accordance with these NHLBI guidelines? And then we wanted to look at whether subjects, particularly children subjects, enrolled in placebo-controlled trials are harmed more than subjects enrolled in other types of research on asthma. The third question we asked is, are children enrolled in the placebo arm? So even if I can say that individuals are more likely to be harmed if they're in a placebo-controlled trial than in an active-controlled trial, I still then have to say, well, in which arm? Are they being harmed because they're being given placebo or because they're being given the experimental drug? And the fourth question, one that I think is even the most important, is generalized knowledge about children as a class being procured? So are we just enrolling children to get our numbers, or are we actually enrolling children because we want to advance pediatric medicine? So our methods were to do a Medline search between January 1998 and December of 2001. And we wanted to, because we were going to hold them to NHLBI guidelines and to the federal regulations, we only wanted to include studies that were done in the U.S. So we excluded research done outside of the U.S. We excluded asthma research if it didn't include at least some pediatric subjects. We only wanted to look at original data, not meta-analysis, and we didn't want to focus on related conditions like allergic rhinitis, which are more minor and which, as Dr. Miller showed, are an exception under the World Medical Association Declaration of Helsinki. So we wanted to focus on acute asthma. And here's what we found. There were 450 studies published during that period, and of those, only 70 met our criteria. Of the 70, 50 used placebos. Now, 45 of them were placebo versus an experimental drug, that experimental drug being almost invariably an inhaled corticosteroid. 5 of them were add-ons, meaning that everybody got anti-inflammatory medication because they had more than mild intermittent asthma, and that's according to the NHLBI guidelines. But now the question is two drugs better than one? So some individuals, for example, were given a leukotriene inhibitor versus placebo. I'm less worried about those 5. I really want to focus on the 45 where we took people, even though we have standard of care, says that everybody belongs on an anti-inflammatory medication. Of our 45 placebo-controlled trials, as you can see, 31 involved children and adults, and 14 only included children. Interestingly, of the 70 studies, remember there are 70, 52 of the 70 involved children and adults. In the articles, only 8 gave us demographic baseline data about the children versus adults, and only 1 gave us data that differentiated between the children and the adults in the results. So 8 at baseline, 1 in results. That means that in 52 studies, children were enrolled, but we only gained information about children as a class in 1 study. That means that in 98% of the studies, children were exposed to the risks of research without any potential to get benefit as a group. The average duration of the trial was at 6 months. Interestingly, we're going to focus on the withdrawal data to see if people were harmed. Only 62 of the 70 studies gave us that information. The 40 of the 45 placebo-controlled trials give us that information. And as you can see, virtually all of them had IRB approval and informed consent, and that should come as no surprise. Most of these studies were being done in order to prove that a new inhaled corticosteroid was more effective than placebo in order to get FDA approval in order to be able to market it in the U.S. As I said, 67 of the studies revealed its funding, 63 of these being a pharmaceutical company, 3 being a pharmaceutical company plus NIH, so 66 of the 67 that told us the source of funding were pharmaceutical companies. So most of these studies were being done as what I would call Me Too studies. We already have one inhaled corticosteroid. This is a really common disease. It's worth billions of dollars. My drug company wants to be involved as well. What's interesting is I look at the changing demographic of who gets enrolled from 1998 and 2001, and this is the number that involves children and adults, 15, with 7 enrolling only children. And as you see, the number starts to fall in the number enrolling only children. In part, this is coming from the NIH change in policy that you need to be including children in all research, so most of the studies are now both children and adults. And what we had was 30,000 subjects about whom we had withdrawal data and subjects enrolled documenting withdrawal information. I'm sorry, it was 25,000. So let's look at those 25,000. So first, this is another way of looking at the study. Were all subjects with more than mild asthma on anti-inflammatory medication prior to the study. So this says that 18 of the 70 were on appropriate medication before the study, and that includes 4 that only enrolled children. But the other 52, so the vast majority of these individuals, despite diagnosis of more than mild intermittent asthma, were not on appropriate medication. What's interesting is that despite the fact that 18 were on appropriate medication before the trial, only 12 remained on it throughout the trial. 6 were randomized into placebo. So we actually took people who were on appropriate medication and took them off in order to answer the question, is this new drug as good or better than is this new drug better than placebo and therefore marketable against the other inhaled corticosteroids that are already on the market? Of the 52 who we knew needed to be on medication, we only placed 10, all of them, on anti-inflammatory medication. So we're clearly not providing standard of care in our research. But here's the answer. When you look at all the subjects, there we go. Of our 25,000 subjects who were enrolled, 11,690 are on these active control and add-on studies. And of our placebo-controlled trials, we have 13,000 individuals. And what you can see is that 19% of individuals withdrew, and 16% withdraw when they're on active control, 21% withdraw when they're in placebo. And what's the reason for withdrawal? Almost half in the placebo trials withdraw because of an asthma exacerbation. In contrast, only 19% who are in an active control study. So clearly these individuals are being harmed. And you won't be surprised, since all of these individuals were known to require anti-inflammatory medication, that when you separate it, the people who are being withdrawn from the asthma exacerbation are more likely to be in the placebo arm. None of this surprised anybody doing the research. All we were doing was to count how many people were harmed in order to argue maybe those requirements about placebo-controlled trials, the ones that we just heard, some very interesting ethical arguments on why we can reject them. We were trying to give numbers to say why they should be accepted. And the reason this is really important is because of the Declaration of Helsinki and the U.S. response to it. So here are our 4 questions, and we'll get back to this Declaration of Helsinki. The first question is, do the studies begin in clinical equipoise? Second question is, when, if ever, are placebo-controlled trials ethical? The third is, when should children be enrolled as first-line participants in research? And the fourth question is, does the consent of the subject ensure that the research was ethical? So the notion of equipoise, as we heard from Dr. Miller at the start of the trial, there must be a state of equipoise such that we don't really know whether arm A is better or worse than arm B. And so I will agree that the key thing is this uncertainty. Here is what Dr. Shapiro, one of the authors of several of the studies of placebo-controlled trials, wrote in the discussion that showed that the individuals in a placebo-controlled trial, those in the placebo arm, did worse than those who got an inhaled corticosteroid. She wrote, asthma symptoms would be expected to worsen in the placebo group during the treatment period because these patients were dependent on inhaled steroids but were not allowed treatment with steroids while in the study. So clearly no equipoise, no uncertainty about which arm was expected to do better. And then the question is, I doubt that she shared this perspective during the informed consent process. So when are placebos ethical? As we saw from Dr. Miller, the Declaration of Helsinki, it actually addressed it for many, many years, although in a more circumspect way than happens when the declaration gets revision. In fact, in the 1975 version, it basically said, in any medical study, every patient, including those of a control group, should be assured the best proven diagnostic and therapeutic method. There are many in the U.S. who want to argue that didn't mean that you couldn't use placebos. But in 2000, this statement was clarified into Article 29, which says the benefits, risks, burdens of a new method should be tested against those of the best current diagnostic and therapeutic method. This does not exclude the use of placebo or no treatment in study where no proven prophylaxis exists. In other words, when we have standard of care, that should be the research. Well, there are a lot of people in the U.S. who felt that this was too stringent, particularly for research, for example, on allergic rhinitis, and there were a lot of debates about it. And so in 2002, we do get this modification, and what it basically said is here are the two exceptions when placebos are ethical. When there's compelling and scientifically sound methodological reasons to determine the safety or efficacy of a drug, clearly doesn't hold when we already have one inhaled corticosteroid for asthma. And more importantly, it says where a prophylactic diagnostic or therapeutic method is being investigated for a minor condition, a condition that leads to over 200 deaths in pediatrics, I don't consider minor. And so in a sense, if we followed the Declaration of Helsinki and all of its modifications in this country, all of these placebo-controlled trials could not have been permitted. So when are placebos ethical? Actually, back in 1977, the American Academy of Pediatrics gave some guidelines pretty similar to the Declaration of Helsinki for when placebos are ethical in pediatric research. It said when no commonly accepted therapy, if the commonly accepted therapy is of questionable efficacy, carries a high frequency of undesirable side effects. Also, you might want to use placebo to determine incidence and severity of undesirable side effects of add-on treatment. And finally, when the disease process is characterized by frequent spontaneous exacerbation, children with asthma do not get better by breathing fresh air, where we wouldn't need asthma drugs in the first place. So asthma research involving placebos, which were ethical, the 50 studies using placebos. In the 45, they were looking at an experimental drug versus placebo were clearly not ethical. The ones that required five that required all to be on an anti-inflammatory medication and were just looking whether two drugs were better than one were ethical. So that's question two. The third question is, so when should a child first policy be ethical? We've already seen my criticisms in the stem cell research. And the question is, there is this trend, as I showed, of increasing the participation of children. And so although the policies, whether we're looking at NIH or FDAMA or any of the other policies of the last two decades, have succeeded in enrolling children, to me the most important thing is, are we getting generalized knowledgeable about pediatrics? And as I've already pointed out, of the 52 studies that enrolled children and adults, only one gave us generalizable knowledge. So that means we're exposing all of these kids to the risks without getting benefit. And finally, then comes this question of, does the consent of the participant ensure that the research was ethical? There was a beautiful question asked about what does this mean about trying to convince people about the therapeutic misconception, and I think that's a really important issue because informed consent is necessary, but it's not sufficient, and that we really need to make sure that subjects, particularly as research subjects are occurring earlier and more frequently in the process, and that we need to refocus our primary responsibility, which is the protection of human subjects, particularly when the human subjects are children. Thank you.
Lainey, I wanted to just push you a little bit on several of the examples that you gave us have flaws in the way the research was done that might apply also if they were simply including adults. So can you say a little bit more about how the fact that they included children made them more problematic or you know, some of those studies, would you approve them even for adults, I guess, is the way I'd ask the question.
So that's a really important question. I mean, the studies, some of these really are scientifically flawed, and we should all be sitting here wondering, how did it get through IRB approval? How did it get through NIH grant review sessions and things of that sort. So that should all give us pause for concern. The question is, is it more or less acceptable because they enroll children? And I would say that at least with adults, if you have a competent adult who understands that you have asthma, your asthma needs an anti-inflammatory medication, and you agree to voluntarily be withdrawn, competent adults are allowed to make a lot of stupid decisions. And so this is just one more competent adult making a stupid decision. Now, unfortunately, it's not as clean as that, because it might be that way if we lived in a country which had national health insurance. But one of the reasons that seems to have gotten missed by both of the speakers this morning is that some of the reasons that people enroll, adults particularly, enroll in this research is because it may be their only access to medical care. So this notion that the subjects understand that it's not being done for their benefit, this may be their only way of getting medical care. So in that context, it is inappropriate that we're enrolling both adults and children. But in a world where adults really had access to medical care, if they chose to voluntarily expose themselves to greater risk, that I would find fine. We do take a more paternalistic role to children, and we ought to, because children can't consent for themselves. And that means their parents have to consent for them. I would like to have more stringent guidelines when it's a surrogate, because they're making the decision, and yet the risks are on a third party. There are data to show that we are much more likely to enroll both our parents and our children in research that we would not enroll in ourselves. No one's surprised when I say we're more likely to enroll our parents, but most people are surprised when I say we're more likely to enroll our children. But that does get to the difference between a surrogate decision maker and a competent adult.
You said that subset analysis of children was needed in order to
justify their participation.
Generalize the knowledge to that group. Why should children be included in any large population, more adult study for the principle of justice if their numbers might not be sufficient to provide subset analysis? Why not simply do a study in children on the same issue?
So there are two reasons for not doing studies just in children. One is it's very hard to get large enough numbers, and so people like to combine children and adults. The reason I feel that you need to have this subset analysis, otherwise you're exposing the children to the risk. So I would agree with you. I would prefer that if this was a problem that was particular to pediatrics, that the study included only children. Because it's sometimes unwieldy to do that, the researchers may combine it, and I would still find that acceptable as long as there's subset analysis plan, so it's second best. But if they're doing it to just get their numbers so that they get the right accrual without any plans for doing subset analysis, so it's very interesting. Right after I was finishing that study, I happened to be doing another study which required a FOIA request, the Freedom of Information Act. I wanted to look at researchers who had requested a certificate of confidentiality from the NIH in order to protect their research subjects. And a couple of the studies were asthma studies, where they wanted to do genetic studies, but to ensure non-insurance discrimination, this is pre-GINA, they decided to get a certificate of confidentiality. And one of the studies that happened to have gotten a certificate of confidentiality was a study in my original sample, and enrolled children and adults. And so I started talking to the researcher after we had finished. So here I am contacting researchers who had gotten a certificate of confidentiality. They were not happy because their whole point was to keep confidentiality, but I explained to them, I'm not looking to breach confidentiality of your subjects. I'm trying to understand why you thought it was necessary to get their certificate. So after we reviewed this study and we looked at why the researcher got a certificate of confidentiality, I said, by the way, I read those studies, and you had a lot of kids, but you didn't do subset analysis. To which he said, intentionally we didn't, because it would have made it actually much more complicated to get FDA approval. We needed accrual numbers, we included children, we happened to get a large subset, but we didn't want to look at subset analysis, because then the FDA would have required more studies in order to get approval for pediatrics. And I was just totally horrified. There was no pretense, since the conversations were done in a confidential manner. I can't disclose names or studies.
I wonder if you could speak to considerations that one might have when choosing to enroll, 2 and 3 year olds versus 16 and 17 year olds.
Right. So the question, so the federal regulations are nice in this regard, right? They say first do the research on animals, then do it on humans, and then do it on older children versus younger children. And that will work with conditions like asthma, but it won't necessarily work for conditions that affect young children. So the answer is, again, we should be more protective of those who can't even, right? So the fact is we should protect children because they can't give informed consent. But the older teenager can at least give an affirmative assent, can surely understand the research and decide whether or not to participate. And for many research, their dissent, their refusal, is binding. 2 and 3-year-olds, we don't seek their dissent. And we wouldn't respect it because, you know, kids cry for lots of reasons, including just seeing the white coat of the doctor, right? The first thing the kid says when they see me is no needles. So you could understand why their participation then, they're more vulnerable because they don't get the right to say no where the older teenager does. So I think it's really important that when thinking about research, if it can be done on older individuals who can give an affirmative assent or dissent, that that be done before we get to the younger child. Now, clearly, you start getting into research like bronchopulmonary dysplasia in premature infants, and you don't have a choice. Thank you very much.
I first want to start by apologizing that the coffee and the snacks weren't there when you came out. Some things I have no control over. For the rest of this morning, we are going to function in this room as an IRB. Now, how many of you have been on IRBs before? Okay, so a few of you. So those of you who have never been on an IRB or been to an IRB will probably like to know that this is a much larger group than most IRBs tend to be. And so it could be a little bit challenging to get everybody to have a voice, but we're going to do our best. I'm going to start by talking about the study a little bit. Hopefully everybody got a chance to read it. So in that regard, I might be sort of wearing the hat of the principal investigator, giving you a few background pieces of information about the study. And then we will discuss the details. And then before you leave today, we're going to vote and decide whether or not this study can be approved. Before we start, just to get a sense of how many people read it, does this study involve a placebo? Raise your hand if it's yes. Okay, well. And does it involve children?
Yes.
Oh, good. A lot of people read it. Okay, good. So we're going to talk about this study. The name of it, of course, is The Role of Nitric Oxide Scavenging by Plasma Hemoglobin and Identification of Hemolysis-Associated Pulmonary Hypertension in Malaria. I'm going to give you some background. Malaria is one of the leading infectious causes of death in many of the world's poorest countries. It's especially a problem in young children. And in Mali, where this study is proposed to take place, one out of every 20 children is estimated to not live to adulthood because of malaria. In other words, they die of malaria in infancy. Malaria often leads to massive hemolysis in infected hosts. And very little is known about the pathogenic impact of hemolysis on the vascular tone and the endothelial function or the clinical consequences of hemolysis in malaria. However, studies in sickle cell disease and other hemoglobinopathies have revealed that hemoglobin released into the plasma during hemolysis destroys and reduces the level of nitric oxide. This loss of nitric oxide leads to many problems, including inflammation, vasomotor constriction, platelet aggregation, and pulmonary hypertension. Pulmonary hypertension and sickle cell disease is associated with a fairly high mortality. About 40% of people with sickle cell and pulmonary hypertension die within 2 years. So part of the question that motivated this study was, does hemolysis in malaria lead to pulmonary hypertension? And is the pulmonary hypertension, if it's there, clinically relevant in malaria in terms of the pathogenesis? So those of you who read like the first 35 pages, this is the summary of those pages. Hopefully I didn't get anything wrong, those of you who know more about this than I do. This protocol then aims to evaluate mechanisms that govern interrelationships among malaria, intravascular hemolysis, nitric oxide bioavailability, endothelial function, pulmonary hypertension, and evolutionarily selected host polymorphisms that regulate the host response to hemolysis. That all makes sense to you? This is what the study is about. Where is it going to be done? It's going to be done in the Republic of Mali, which is in West Africa, home to about 12 million people. The median age is about 15. Approximately two-thirds live below the poverty line. Approximately 90% are Muslim. Approximately 80% are illiterate. And the languages that are spoken in Mali are English, French, and Bambara. Most people speak the latter of the three, which is the local language, or some dialect. The primary objective of my study, our study, is to compare the prevalence and magnitude of pulmonary hypertension in children with severe malarial anemia to that in healthy controls. And for this study, pulmonary hypertension is being defined as a tricuspid regurgitant velocity of greater than or equal to 2.5 meters per second. There are several secondary objectives. We're going to look at the degree and spectrum of intravascular hemolysis in malaria, quantify the effect of hemolytic rate on nitric oxide bioavailability, determine the biological characteristics of hemolysis-associated endothelial dysfunction, and determine the genetic basis of certain disease phenotypes that are relevant to the pathogenesis of malaria. Statistically, we're going to test the null hypothesis that the mean tricuspid regurgitant velocity is the same in those with severe malarial anemia and healthy controls. We're setting the significance at p less than or equal to 0.05, and doing so means that we need 100 analyzable subjects in each treatment group in order to get 80% power to detect a difference of 0.2 meters per second in the TRV. Because of differences in the inadequacies sometimes in the scanning, we're going to need to enroll about 125 participants in each group in order to get 100 analyzable subjects. We'd like to enroll 125 subjects, therefore, in each of four groups. 125 healthy controls, asymptomatic controls, these are people who have parasitemia on smear but no symptoms, uncomplicated malaria, and severe malarial anemia, and the differences between these two groups are spelled out in the protocol. However, due to the funding that we have, we're going to start with group A and group D, just enroll healthy controls and children with severe malarial anemia to start with. If we see a difference between those two groups, then we will try to enroll the other two groups to see a more fine grain difference. We're going to conduct the study at the, I don't speak French, so Hôpital Gabriel Touré or something like that, a major tertiary center and the National Pediatric Hospital that's in Bamako, Mali. There's a long history of collaboration, investigators at this center with the NIH and specifically NHLBI and NIAID. And in this particular study, we're going to enroll subjects who are children between the ages of 1 and 5 years of age. Parents who bring their children to the hospital for suspected malaria will be invited to enroll their sick child in the study and also invited to enroll the healthy siblings as controls. This way, we'll be able to enroll both the children with severe malarial anemia and the healthy controls, sometimes from the same families. The hospital admits during the rainy season, or during the peak malaria season, admits 100 to 300 children with severe malaria every month, so we don't think we'll have any problem getting children from this setting. We're going to ask for consent or permission of the parent or the legally authorized guardian. The consent form is translated into French, and it will be presented to parents in the local language when they don't speak French or when they cannot read. Parents will either provide a signature or a thumbprint on the form to indicate their agreement, and the children in this study, being 1 to 5 years old, are too young to provide assent. Parents who agree to enroll their child will be given 5,000 CFAs, which is equivalent to about $10 in the United States, for the initial visit, and $5,000 for the second, 5,000 CFA for the second visit. This money is to cover travel and lodging expenses for parents who don't live near the research site. The initial evaluation will take about 2 to 3 hours, and there'll be a follow-up visit after treatment for malaria 7 to 10 days later. And the evaluation will involve these procedures. There'll be first a finger stick to evaluate whether or not the child has malaria. There'll be a history and physical. There'll be an echocardiogram to evaluate the presence of pulmonary hypertension. There'll be blood drawn to do genetic analysis, with the total blood volume being about 9 to 12 milliliters, well within the guidelines of what's acceptable for children. And stored blood will be collected to save for future research related to malaria. The history and physical and the echocardiogram and a blood draw will be repeated after 7 to 10 days. All of those children who are invited to participate and who have malaria will be treated for malaria free of charge according to the local standard of care in Bamako, even if they end up not enrolling in the pulmonary hypertension study. And we expect that up to 50% of children that we finger test for the presence of malaria will actually be found to be parasitemic even though they're asymptomatic, and we will treat those children as well at no cost to their parents. Our genetic analysis is going to be limited to genetic regions associated with malarial pathogenesis, protective traits, nitric oxide dysregulation, and pulmonary hypertension. We're not going to be looking for other kinds of disease susceptibilities or other DNA studies. The samples will be stored in Mali, but some proportion of the samples will be sent to the United States, to the NIH, for future research. Okay. So you are the IRB presented with this study. You need to decide whether, after you've reviewed the study and discussed the different aspects of it with each other, whether you want to approve it with stipulations, table it, or reject it. So how would you like to begin? Anybody want to make a statement about what they think the ethical acceptability of this study is, or any aspects thereof? Yes. Can you come to the mic? As I said in previous classes, we have people in other sites that are watching us, so use the mics. I have some volunteers who are going to take a portable mic around if it's hard for you to get out of your corners there. So,
please. So the ethical issues are divided into informed consent, beneficence, and justice. And justice does not really apply since it's study in children. The question is, why should it be? Because that's the prevalent group in which you have a 30% mortality after hospitalization for complications of malaria. The implication being that if you delayed into adulthood, you wouldn't have the same patient population to study. So in this case, justice for the issue of children is sort of self-evident. In informed consent, the main problem is the fact that they have multi-languages and illiteracy and limited comprehension. The points in favor of supporting the way the informed consent document is set up, which appears to be complete in all the required elements, is that the outfit there in the Capitol has been in existence for a while. They've actually had field tests of similar studies, so they have troubleshot the system. They have it in French, which is their official language, and they have interpreters that can identify the local dialect to speak to the parents or legal guardian of the child in the local dialect. And the implication is, with their background and with this language difficulty dealt with, that the informed consent seems very reasonable. It's also reasonable because the study is probably minimal risk. The risk is not treating, but you're going to have early detection by nature of volunteering for the project. And a echocardiogram that's specifically looking for the heart valve problem and a finger stick are in and of themselves minimal risk. So there's low risk, and generalizable knowledge to be gained to apply to all the children in the Mali and sub-Saharan Africa in the future. So the risk and benefit ratio seems favorable, and that upholds the element of beneficence. So I thought on virtually all of, and there's a lot more language in there, how the investigators have really made an effort to go the extra mile to cover all the ethical issues that might surface when you're in a low-resource country applying an elegant scientific study to an illiterate group. And they've done that very carefully.
Okay. So does everybody agree with that analysis, that all the bases are covered basically by appealing to informed consent, justice, and beneficence, and therefore the study is okay, and we can just go ahead and approve it? Everybody agree with that? Does anybody disagree? Does anybody want to recommend that there's other things we should be discussing? Or please.
I would like to recommend that the beds are, there's not enough bed space in there, I think, because they're going to roll 650 patients. They have a 10-bed hospital. Even though they say they have a 100 to 300, I don't know if it's going to be in Bambia. But I think that it's not right, because I think it's coercion, because the kids are going to be in the hospital for malaria anyways, and they're going to pull the human subjects in that are the siblings and give them both the finger sample tests. And I don't think that's ethical.
So you're worried about coercion of the siblings or the patients themselves?
Of the patients themselves and the parents.
And the parents.
Because they are illiterate, and I've read the consent form, and it's hard for me to understand it, so how could they understand it? They talk about the echocardiogram, they talk about the finger sticks, they talk about genetics.
Okay.
But they don't have risks, or they don't really have risk or benefits, and they will re-enroll if you get malaria. In which case, if the healthy person gets malaria, there's a problem. You made them sick. It's a risk.
How did we make them sick?
Well, if they already have the parasites in them, they have the same finger sticks, the shots that they give. And I think if they said that there is a risk that they will, if they get re-enrolled if they get malaria.
Okay. So we have one speaker who wants to approve the study because all of the bases are covered. We have another speaker who believes that there's coercion of both the parents and the siblings and the patients, and a worry about re-enrolling participants. Go ahead.
I would just have one question for the investigators. My question would be, it sort of has to do with the concern about doing research in developing countries where certain healthcare may not be available. So in the process of doing this research, they may identify a number of patients with pulmonary hypertension, which now gives those patients a new diagnosis, which is another disease that can require treatment and can be severe and can have many effects on a person. And so my question would be, what are they then going to recommend to the parents of those children who now have a diagnosis of pulmonary hypertension? And is there a plan in place to provide them care for that now new diagnosis? Or do they know of what the resources are at that location for caring for these patients in the
okay.
future?
Did anyone see that addressed in the protocol?
Yeah.
What did it say? Including pulmonary hypertension?
Not including pulmonary hypertension. Well, that's kind of unclear. Definitely valvular heart disease, systolic or diastolic.
Okay, so there are two issues here. One is the one that you identified, which is they are looking for pulmonary hypertension. What do they do if they find it? Do they treat it? Do they refer people? Do they do anything? The second one is...
They are referring,
okay.
Yeah.
And the other one is the one you just raised, that they described they may encounter other kinds of cardiac problems, like valvular problems and other, when they're doing the echo, that they might not be able to do anything about. Dan.
Okay. I have been on an IRB, and I just didn't see too many hands go up about other people having done it. This protocol actually has been reviewed before by an ethics committee at the NIH, and their decisions were taken into account when this protocol was drawn up, and their decisions and recommendations are summarized in Appendix A. And unless I missed it, Appendix A was not attached to the handout. So none of my colleagues on this IRB have done due diligence because they didn't look to see what the recommendations were and whether this protocol conformed to it.
Okay. Well, that's a good comment, and I will take responsibility for eliminating Appendix A. But I also will tell you that Appendix A was not the review of the IRB, but was rather the recommendations of the Ethics Consult Team, which was our department, about a specific aspect of benefits to the participants. And I'd be happy to explain that to you later, but I think in some respects I want us to step away from that just for one second. I mean, we may say we can't review this unless we see Appendix A. But I also want to say sometimes, more often than not, you're going to get a protocol that has not thought about some of these ethical issues ahead of time, has not sought an ethics consult, and you have to make a decision about what to do based on what you're given. And so for a moment, let's try to do that, but I think it's a very good point. Yes?
Yeah. I have a whole host of worries, and they all come down to the fact that from an American perspective, this protocol looks fine. But once this informed consent form is going to be translated into, I think it was Bambero, which the local language was, what happens? Because does Bambero have a word for informed consent? Is there a concept of informed consent in that culture? If you can come up with a translation, how are people going to perceive it? I don't know anything about the local culture. I don't know anything about the relation between how the relationship between patients and doctors is being conceived. I don't know about who in this culture is normally the person that decides for children. Is that the parents? Is it just the dad? Is it just the mom? Is it the extended family? I don't know how this is going to be perceived in the larger community when stories come back. I don't know what access to treatment is normally, what access to healthcare is for these people. I don't know what 10 United States dollars buys in that country, but if it's one of the poorest countries in the world, that may be equivalent to at least 10 days worth of salary. That seems a lot of money. All these people aren't, most people, 80% of the country is not illiterate. They may be told what's in a consent form, but they won't have something that they can consult back to. All these issues are just out there. So I would at the very least like to talk to someone who knows the local culture and mm-hmm. the local language. I would like to see a reverse translation of the informed consent form, so translated into their language, translated back to English by someone else. I would like to know something about how they conceive of informed consent. I would like to know whether this culture values autonomy or whether they value other things. All those things.
Okay. So may I, before you go away, may I characterize most of your worries under the rubric of informed consent and choosing the particular population there? Not so much to do with the science, but more to do with the fact that we're going to Bamako and we're going to enroll Malian children, and we don't know enough about Mali and the relationship of Malians with their parents and their providers and the culture and what they understand. I mean, that's pretty much what you said.
Yeah, and I mean, my worry is not even so much can these people give informed consent. My worry is the question can they informed consent even the relevant question to ask in this situation, because that's a whole notion and a whole concept of ethics and values that is particular to this country, I mean, perhaps to Northwestern Europe and America and a few other countries. But I can't even begin to translate that.
Okay. So this presents a very interesting issue for IRBs, and the question is, what do you do about that? You can ask many of the questions that you pose, you could ask of the PI. And the PI will have some data and responses and experiences, et cetera. As an IRB, you can also bring in a consultant, somebody who does know something about the culture there, You could even arrange for some kind of a conversation with somebody on the ground in Mali. I mean, there are things you can do. But in the end, once you get some of those pieces of information, then you need to make a decision about whether it's good enough or not. So I'm going to come back to that afterwards. Yeah.
I guess my question is a little bit more clinical, and it pertains to the concept of risk. Just looking through this protocol basically outlines the blood draw of about 9 to 12 cc's of blood, and the ages are between 1 to 5 years of age.
Right.
I'm just thinking about the worst-case scenario. I'm a pediatrician, so from the pediatrician's perspective, let's say in the smallest child, 1 year of age, with severe hemolytic anemia from malaria, even if they take 9 cc's of blood, which seems to be the minimum amount on the protocol,
right,
it's a significant amount of blood. On page 19 on table 3, they do have a footnote that says that they may give a blood transfusion to offset the minor phlebotomies associated with the study.
Right.
And it's not clear to me whether, you know, this is part of routine care where the kid would have required a blood transfusion anyway because of severe hemolytic anemia. Maybe it is, or maybe because to offset the phlebotomy, they're giving a blood transfusion. Now, blood transfusion is pretty routine in the U.S. We have very strict criteria for the kind of blood we give to our patients. But, again, I call the question the kind of blood transfusion that may be given in a quite poor, resource-deprived country, and especially if we're not putting the patients at greater risk because of this procedure. Again, 12 cc's of blood in a one-year-old is a pretty good amount. It's about three big tubes full of blood to four. So I looked for the answer in the risk section. I didn't quite see the explanation there. There's about four lines under risk and discomforts under blood draw, and it's a pretty generic. It's what we put on everything for risks associated with phlebotomy.
Okay, before you sit down, since you're a pediatrician, the exclusion criteria does exclude kids who have a very low hemoglobin. So one question for you as the pediatrician on our IRB is that the right level of exclusion? Should you exclude kids with even a little bit higher hemoglobin, or is that the right choice, what they made? I think it's 5 is what they chose.
5 is a pretty small amount.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's one issue. Should they exclude kids more with higher hemoglobins? The second issue, which you raise, is a very important one, is the risks of drawing blood in children, in very young children with very low hemoglobins. And the question is, did they adequately address how they're going to adjust blood drawing for those children, and also, as you raise, what's the point, what's the relevance of the transfusion? Would these children need it anyway, clinically? And if not, is it justified to give it to them? And then the last issue you raised about the same concern is, what do you tell the parents about the risks? So those, I just wanted to show you that those are different. They're all related to the blood, but they're different. They're exclusion criteria, they're whether the risks are acceptable, they're what are the plans for transfusion and whether that's justified, and they're related to the consent, whether or not what is told to the parents is adequate. I thought they were excluded if they were lower than 5. Okay, so they're in group 4. Right, you're right. They're excluded if they're excluded from group 3, but they're enrolled in group 4. You're right. Okay. Yep.
As I understand it, when doing research in the developing world, there's a need to meet a criteria of responsiveness.
Okay.
And responsiveness addresses either healthcare priorities or healthcare needs.
Okay.
Now, and this is to prevent exploitation, I understand. Now, it's not clear to me as to whether pulmonary hypertension is either a healthcare priority or a particular healthcare need in Mali. Clearly, malaria is, but if pulmonary hypertension is not a recognized either priority or particular need, do these people then become a convenience sample, which is really serving the purposes of people that have an interest in pulmonary hypertension in other settings, and raising the potential that this research may be exploitative?
Okay. Let me challenge this a little bit. I think this is an important notion, and we're going to have more discussion of this in a couple of weeks when we talk about international research. But I'm going to respond as the PI now. I'm going to say, okay, but pulmonary hypertension might be a huge problem in malaria in Mali and places like Mali that have high rates of malaria. This is just the first step. The first step is to try to find out if these kids have pulmonary hypertension. So it is, I mean, it may not be responsive in the sense that they've identified we want to do something about pulmonary hypertension, and they don't even know yet whether it's there. On the other hand, if we're able to show that it's a very prevalent phenomena in kids with severe malaria, it may be the way to improve treatment for these children. So isn't that responsive?
Yeah, the question needs to be asked. I was not raising it to say that that excludes us from being in an appropriate trial.
Okay.
I was impressed by it was very clear that all patients will be provided antimalarial care, irrespective as to whether they would be entering a study or not. So, just in terms of the strong precautions they'd taken to make sure this did not become a coercive factor.
Okay. So, before I go to you, Carl, I want to stop for 1 second because Zeke usually does this session, and he's much more ruthless than I am. And he would stop you at this point and say, what are you guys doing? You're talking popcorn. You're not following any kind of systematic way of evaluating whether or not this study is worth doing and approvable. So what systematic way have we ingrained in you is worth using for figuring it out? And so what he would say is, of course, start with these first 8 ethical requirements and ask yourself systematically, how does it fare? How does this study fare if you start at the top and go down? Now, we've had people who said justice and risk and informed consent and coercion and exploitation and responsiveness. I mean, these are all important notions. But do we have any sort of systematic overall way of assessing whether or not this study, as it's proposed, is acceptable? And so this is one possible way to do that. So let's take a minute. I don't want to, your question may be not related to this, but let's take a minute and sort of try to address these questions. What do you think? Do you see any evidence of satisfactory collaborative partnership in this study? I see some heads nodding, but okay, so there's no American names on it. That's, again, my fault. I was tried to redact names from the protocol, and I obviously didn't succeed in completely. But this is an NIH-sponsored study. It's funded by the NIH. There are NIH investigators involved. There are Tulane University investigators involved, and there are University of Bamako investigators involved. There are many Malian clinicians involved on the ground at the Gabriel Touré Hospital. So there's a lot of different players. Any other views on this notion of collaborative partnership? Okay, here's a question. Where are they going to fix the echocardiograms? Is that part of collaborative partnership? Okay, the question is access to electricity. There certainly is electricity at the hospital. And I don't know, actually, but let's presume for the moment that there are people who are trained in being able to not only operate but fix the echocardiogram machine on the ground. Okay, what about social value? Any ideas on whether or not this study has social value, if you remember what it is? Yeah.
I was just going to say that if she looks at page 9, there's a whole section, 2.6, talks about NIH, University of Bamako, Tulane. I mean, there's a huge infrastructure, and it even,
right,
you know, discusses how it links back to the Bethesda land.
It's okay.
Not like they're out in a, you know, in a cave without communications and
right,
that kind of thing.
Thank you. So there actually is a whole section in the protocol that describes the collaboration and the long-standing collaboration that this is built on. This is not a come in, do the study, go home kind of study. And the investigator actually took some pains to spell that out. So our job is to decide, is that good enough? That's one question. So what about social value as the second? Yeah. Can you go to the mic or get a mic? One or the other. Thanks.
I guess, you know, you had said earlier that 1 in 20 children in Mali are affected by malaria. So even though the statistic might be a little bit lower than, you know, expected, it still provides social value to the country as a whole, since it is affected by malaria, you know, from kids to adults. And their median age is 15, so they can prevent it from a young age. Maybe you could see the benefits of the study sort of impacting the rest of their life and even the quality of life.
Okay, so you're basing the social value on the data that suggested that malaria is a huge problem in children in Mali, which is definitely true. I think an interesting way to push you, though, is what about the pulmonary hypertension? I mean, the goal of this study is to find out if there's pulmonary hypertension. And so it makes us go one step beyond. Yes, malaria is a very serious problem. Are you convinced by the scientific analogies that are made in the protocol to other similar diseases that have massive hemolysis that this could be a big problem in malaria, and therefore it's worth investigating? And in response to, I think, what Nathan said before, you know, the first step is really to find out, is there pulmonary hypertension in these kids? And this is all we're trying to do here. I mean, it's not all, but it's the primary objective of our study. Yeah.
Can we treat pulmonary hypertension?
Good question. And there was a question earlier about, you know, what do we do if we find pulmonary hypertension in these kids?
Just to say, I mean, we may have to answer the question, but if pulmonary hypertension is not something we can really treat, and for all I remember, you can't very well. I mean, once it's there, it's there. Then I don't know what the social value is.
Well, there are some treatments that are used for pulmonary hypertension. There's also a very high mortality rate from pulmonary hypertension. So the question is multifold, I think. One is, what treatments for pulmonary hypertension are available in Mali? Secondly, is it related to high mortality or not? I mean, there are people walking around apparently with pulmonary hypertension. I don't know that much about it, but with no symptoms and no problem. So I think the question is it present? How bad is it with respect to the clinical consequences? Are treatments available? Can we give them to these kids, or should we not give them to these kids? I mean, these are the questions that you posed a little while ago. Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess my question is this really the place to start in children who are 1 to 5? Certainly they have a high prevalence of malaria, and it's an issue for them, but and they are going to get some treatment, but aren't there other ways for them to get treatment? You know, the goal is not to find a better way to treat them.
Right.
It's to find out if there's pulmonary hypertension. Couldn't that be done in adults first, if that is the question? You know, is there pulmonary hypertension?
So let me argue a little bit that, you know, malaria is much more prevalent and a different kind of problem in young children than it is in adults. Adults get it, sure, not as frequently, and they don't get as sick generally. Kids get more sick. So therefore, to really see severe malarial anemia, we need to study children.
Do you need to study children that are that young?
Yes. Because as they get older, they don't get as sick, basically.
Okay.
So, I mean, again, I'm responding to your concern, but you as the IRB member have to decide, is that convincing enough? Is that convincing enough for you to say, okay, do this study in children that are 1 to 5 in Mali? What about validity, scientific validity? I'm going to push us down the line here a little bit. Anybody want to respond to that, or did you have other questions?
I had a comment, which may not be looked upon favorably, but as someone who's worked in a lot of developing countries in the clinical role, kids die, and kids die all the time.
Right.
And parents are a lot more likely to subject their kids to all kinds of things, and they don't perceive death the way we do,
right.
And we need to be cognizant of that.
Okay, let me ask you a question. That's a very important observation. What does that mean? Does that mean we can do more things than we would do in kids that don't die, or does that mean we have to protect them more than we would?
I think we have to protect them more. I think this, from our how we look at it, when I go to these countries, they subject. For example, I'll give you one perfect example. I was in Russia. These parents wanted these kids to have surgery. They lied and lied and lied, and the reason we found out they lied about the kids. clinical history was the guy who was our interpreter had been a spy, and he said, I'm telling you these parents are lying. Well, anyway, they consented. We took the kid to the OR. They gave the kid some atropine. The kid immediately went into cardiac arrest. He had a congenital anomaly that wasn't picked up that we didn't know about because we were doing minor surgery on this kid. But so that's just one example. And in many countries, you know, kids die all the time, and it's really acceptable to them.
Okay, so let me pick on your example a little bit. So is the moral of that story not to do the study? Or not to trust the parents, or, I mean, what's the moral?
I think the moral is to be cognizant of that. And they lie not because they're bad people. They lie because they want their kid to have the surgery.
Right.
And they want their kid to be enrolled, and they want their kid to get better.
Okay.
But they also don't understand the risks. And sometimes if the kid does die, it's not the same perception as what it is to us when kids die.
Okay.
So it happens all the time.
May I suggest that two things that you pointed out, which I think are very important. One is that culture matters, which is something that was said before. We need to understand the culture. But secondly, that we have to be very cognizant of what motivates parents to put their kids in a study, whether or not the motivations, you know, might rise to the level of what Alan was talking about last week. Is it unduly inducing in some way for these parents? And we also have to be very concerned about what the parents understand, whether they understand what they're doing, what the risks are, et cetera. I mean, those are important messages from what you just said. Okay. Are you working us down this line, or you got another?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. I have one question. What is polymorphisms?
Polymorphisms.
Because being the non-scientist here, I don't understand what that is.
Okay.
And that's one of the parts of the, that's one of the protocol aims, is to investigate the characterization.
It's DNA, basically. It's genetics.
What does that have to do with scientific validity of that community, and what are they trying to find
out? What does that have
to
do with what?
What does that have to do with the scientific validity of that community? And they do talk about polymorphisms in Africa, Southeast Asia, and parts of the...
Because one of the aims, the secondary aims of this study, is to collect DNA on the participants to test the hunch, or it's not really a hypothesis as written, but that some people have mutations in their nitric oxide, the genes that control nitric oxide, that might protect them from things like hemolysis and malaria, and other people might have mutations that make them more susceptible. So they want to try to sort out, do these kids have any of those genetic mutations? Okay, working down. Risks. Yeah, go ahead. Jesse.
Well, this is still with regard to number 3.
Okay.
So I think there should also be the concern that because of funding constraints, they're only enrolling groups A and D first, which suggests that it's possible that the requirements for B and C will never be fulfilled, which are necessary to delineate the critical differences in vascular function and also nitrous oxide pathology.
Mm-hmm.
And so this might undermine the scientific and thus ethical validity of the study.
Okay. It's a very important consideration, and the question is, do we think it will? Because, I mean, the first, as they explain, or as I understand what they explain, the first thing they want to see is there a difference in the TRV between the most severe and the most healthy group? And if there's no difference, then it doesn't matter about enrolling the others. If there is a difference that they can measure and it reaches their threshold, then they'll look for funding to get the other two groups and finish the study to preserve that scientific project. Does that satisfy you?
Yes, it does. I just wasn't clear on what it meant by given funding constraints.
Yes, that's my understanding. Yep.
I have an issue with the risks in the way they're presented in the
okay.
consent document. In the section, there's three sections, blood draws, ultrasound echocardiograms, and genetic studies. In the section on ultrasound and echocardiograms, it says there are no major complications associated with them. And that's there's no information. I mean, I wonder whether that means that there's no complications at all. And if there are non-major complications, what are those complications? It seems to be that should be said there.
Okay.
So
let me just respond to that one for a second. So as an IRB member, You might ask your fellow IRB members, does anybody else know more about ultrasound than I do? Or ask the PI, what are the complications of doing an ultrasound? And the question is, first, are there any? And then second, are they adequately described in the consent document?
Right, because, I don't know whether there are or not, but it's regarding that something else should be said here in the informed consent form, because the parent might be as ignorant as I am about the topic, and you don't want him to have to guess. In that same paragraph, it says, by taking part in this study, you might find out if your child has pulmonary hypertension or sickle disease or other condition that could upset you. Some of the disorders identified may not have available treatment in Mali. I guess that some of the disorders identified may well have available treatment in Mali, and it seems to be appropriate to say in those cases what's going to happen.
Okay.
In terms of informing the parents. I know there's more information in the in the actual protocol, but I think that should be included there.
Okay, so you're along the lines of what was said earlier. We need to say more about what happens when you find pulmonary hypertension. Will we treat it? Will we refer you? Will we tell you you have it? And that's the end. So I'm going to push for a second, Owen. Don't go away. We have about 5 minutes left, and probably the most important thing that we have to decide as an IRB is whether the risks are acceptable given the value of the study and the benefits to the participants. And this is especially critical in children because the regulations require us not only to do the regular justification that we do all the time, but we also have to make a determination. Does this study have any prospect of benefit to these children, number one? And number two, what is the level of risk? Is it minimal risk? Is it minor increment above minimal risk? Or is it greater than a minor increment above minimal risk? And by regulation, those three categories have very different meanings in terms of whether or not we can approve it. So can I get somebody to talk to what the risks and benefits are? Is that what you were going to talk to?
Actually, sort of. I mean, the investigators seem to explicitly believe that the risks are minimal. It's a natural history study, so it's just trying to see the progression of the condition.
Right.
I guess the blood draw might be, the pediatrician had mentioned earlier, might be one a risk that was underemphasized.
Okay.
Maybe it should be kept in mind. But I think one of the interesting points is that the investigators seem to believe that the benefits far outweigh the risk, the benefits specifically of free treatment if it's determined the child has malaria. And whereas they might not normally get such free treatment or at least such high quality treatment, the possibility then might be that at least there's a perception of it being an overly beneficial study. And actually, my other point was that we should be ensured that some people aren't there is an over demand for participation in the study simply because a lot of people think it's going to be their only hope for their children to get potential malarial treatment.
Okay, so what do you mean by overly beneficial?
Oh, sorry, that's the wrong term. I mean, it would be overly large demand for the participants in the study, such that someone might, an investigator might want to put their family in and try to,
Okay, so you're worried that the parents might see the benefits of getting free malarial treatment and then enroll for that reason when they really don't want to. But it is true that the investigators said that they would offer treatment for malaria to any child that needs it, whether or not they enrolled in the study.
Okay.
So that may get to your worry?
I mean, there's limited resources at the hospital. I mean, it's not that,
let's assume they're going to treat everybody they say they're going to treat.
Oh, if there's enough funding for it, then that's great. I mean, I was suspicious that.
NIH is going to pay for it.
But then...
we're rich.
If there was so much, why then is the study limited to the A and D groups because of funding, if there's abundant funding?
Because we're spending it on malaria treatment. Those are complexities that I don't have an answer to. But let's assume that they're all, every kid, as they said, every kid who's approached who has malaria will be treated whether or not they enroll in the study. What about, Owen just suggested that this is minimal risk. Does everybody agree with that?
I have a quick question.
If
you have more than 100 subjects or 125 subjects, how will you turn away the remaining of the population?
Say that one more time, I'm sorry.
If you have more than 125 volunteers who basically because of the financial reasons, how will you make determination who to turn away?
It's first like come, first serve.
First come. That can create a situation like if there is a big line outside.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I mean, would that we had the problem of people lining up for studies. I think most studies have the opposite problem. Where do we get our participants from? But you're right. In a study like this, it is not inconceivable that there will be more kids who need treatment for malaria then we can enroll in our study if we're only enrolling 125. So I'm going to propose, as the PI, we just take the first 125. Is that okay?
And if the child gets sick after the first treatment, you will basically disqualify the child?
If they get sick after treating for malaria, they continue
time.
To have malaria, yes. Or they get malaria again?
Yeah, miss. No. What I'm saying, like after the first blood drawn or the treatment,
yes.
The condition gets worsened.
Yes.
And the child has to be treated. So it will it compromise the study for the second trip?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the kids will be, if they're sick enough to be admitted to the hospital, they will be. I assume a lot of them will not be. They will be treated for malaria. They will be tested again in 7 to 10 days. There probably are going to be some children who will die in that 7-day period, and we won't be able to test them again. And there will be some kids that are too sick to test again. So, I mean, that's built into the statistics.
So if the child dies, there is no financial compensation?
For death?
No, for the second enrollment, because...
No, because they're not in the study the second time. Yeah.
So I think the procedures that the investigators are proposing are minimal risk, except for one thing. And I think it pulls together a couple of the themes that people have talked about and probably could be addressed by knowing more about the culture. The one risk I see is that you may identify using echocardiogram an abnormality of some sort and give them a diagnosis that may not have treatment, as the study investigators state in Mali. The question I have is, will that then cause the parents or other people in that country to now treat that child differently than if they had never been diagnosed, which most of these children probably would not have had an echocardiogram and would not have been diagnosed? And will that limit then these children's ability to do certain things, go to school, participate in activities? You know, this is a question that probably could be addressed by knowing more about the culture, but I see that as a potential risk.
Okay. And that goes back to the point that was made earlier about needing somebody who knows more about the culture. Okay, we have 1 minute left. We need to vote. How many of you will approve this study as is? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Well, let's say about 15. Okay, how many would like to approve it with stipulations, even though we haven't spelled out what those are yet? Okay, that looks like more than 15. How many would like to table it, which basically means the investigators go back to the drawing board and revise major issues with respect to design or risk levels or things like that? Couple, okay. And who would like to reject it? Nobody. Okay. Well, thank you. And next week we're going to talk about risks and benefits to start with, and more of these great conversations, and I appreciate your work as the IRB. We took way too long to do one protocol, though.